This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
And this coming year, I'll have 10 students. I have sometimes taught grades 1 and 2, grades 1, 2, and 3, and our school used to be a small school, and now it's one of the largest schools in the area, so kind of been teaching a range. I've taught grades, just grade 1 for, this will be the 8th year, I guess, that it's just been grade 1. That first year that I just had one grade, there'll be 8th graders this year. I have taught first grade for 21 years, so maybe I know what I'm doing, maybe I don't. Last year I was throwing a loop. I had a student I'd never taught, like somebody like that before, so you might have that type of child the very first year you teach. Do you have it? Is it going or is it okay? All right, so we are talking about first graders here, and I want to go back a slide here. Okay, we're talking about first grade, we're talking about the first days of first grade or the first half of the year of first grade. Hopefully at the end, I might have a little time for some questions. You probably will have a lot of questions. And maybe, as Jonas said, you don't know what all those questions are going to be. Hopefully, I can help you out at the end with some questions and we can get some answers. If not from me, there's some other people here that have a wide variety of experience. So maybe somebody will have met your situation before. And I'm going to make a disclaimer right at the very beginning. I don't like to teach first grade the first 3 weeks of school. It's a lot of work for the teacher, and sometimes you just feel like you're not getting anywhere. So after you get them in, first grade's a lot of fun. So we're going to talk a little bit about what a first grader is. What is a first grader? Let me introduce you, and my mouse likes to do funny things here. Let me introduce you to one of my little friends, or he could be a wide variety of my little friends, but he might be 6 or 7, or perhaps he's just still 5 years old, and he walks into your classroom door on that first day of school. He may have been in your school before, he may not have been in your school before, depending on the circumstances and situations. He probably comes in a little timidly, unless you're like one of my first graders last year, whose father was the chairman of the school board, and they had spent many hours at school, and so he knew all about where he was going. Some come excitedly. Actually, most of them come in rather excitedly. This is brand new experience. Some might come kind of reluctantly. But all of them, each child who enters your first grade door has some things in common. And I thought the talk this morning set this up so well. I'm just kind of, he just expanded on what I was thinking about here, this first little part. For one thing, all of these children are precious to Christ. He's the one who said, "Let the children come to me." And we do well to remember that each one of those children Jesus loves, even little Johnny, whom you're going to have to tell 10 times a day to walk or to sit down or whatever needs to be done. Even little Susie, who doesn't remember that she's ever seen that word before, and it's been there for a long time now. Jesus loves them all. They also come with great potential. They have the potential to be great in the kingdom of God. I mean, maybe they aren't going to be great as we think of great, but each person is great in the eyes of God. And they have potential to learn the many things you have to teach them. Some have more potential than others, but even the child with very limited ability has great potential to learn some things. Does this sound like a small task? No, not really. A first grader is usually enthusiastic about learning and about school. It doesn't take a lot of motivation to get them excited and enthused. They're not like these 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th graders that rather reluctantly drag themselves in the school door and aren't ready for summer to be over yet. A first grader is not hard to get enthused. A first grader is loyal. I've had many first graders tell me, Miss Martin, you're just the best teacher we've ever had. Well, guess what? I'm the only teacher they've ever had. A first grader is impressionable. They take their teacher's word at face value. You're likely to be the first authority figure outside of their parents that they're going to have a lot of interaction with. And you are their hero. I know my first grade teacher, she was my hero. So you need to watch your words and watch your actions, because they're going to talk like you talk, say the words you say. They're going to even sneeze like you sneeze if you sneeze. They're going to read books to their dolls like you read to them. And sometimes what the teacher says has more weight than what even mom and dad say, especially if it's a school subject that they think you know a lot about. A first grader is curious. He wants to know about everything, even sometimes things that really aren't his business, and you have to teach them that. Use his curiosity to propel a lesson forward. A first grader is creative. Their creativity is not on a level of some people's creativity, but a child is very creative. Somewhere I read that we send a child to school and stifle their creativity. So they're very creative if you give them a way to use their creativity. A first grader also is going to need his shoes tied several times a day, probably. He's going to be told to go look in the mirror after lunch and possibly wash his pizza sauce off his mouth. They need to be told a lot of things because in one sense, I used to think, okay, this child's ready for school, so they should know a lot of stuff. You know, they should have a lot of things that they know. They're still learning. A few random thoughts, and these are rather random. They're not very organized, to keep in mind for a successful beginning. The first grade child usually wants to please. He likes to please his peers, but it's more important to please his teacher. So he's usually going to try to do what you want him to do. And if you think a child is capable of doing something, he generally is. If you think, he's got a little problem and I'm just not sure he can do it, he's not going to learn to do it. Now, you might, as a teacher, if you think he's capable of doing it, you as a teacher might be working harder to get that to come out. Don't sell a child short just because you think he's incapable of doing something. But you do need to have realistic expectations. It's not realistic to think that you can teach all your first graders all the multiplication tables in the first year of school. Maybe some of them are capable of doing that, but most aren't. A first grader comes to school, and it's a different environment than he's ever encountered before. He has to sit still for a sustained period of time. They sit in church. Where else do they sit still for 6 hours a day? He also needs to focus more on more than his wants for the main part of the day. Their activity is directed. They are to do what the teacher says, not just jump from one toy to the next. He needs to pay attention, even when he doesn't want to. He needs to learn routines, and he needs to learn to follow those routines. So when you start first grade, remember that the child is coming into something they've never done before. And here's some ways to break them into that. Provide short breaks frequently. Sometimes it's actual breaks. Go out to the water fountain, or you have a recess break, lunch break, snack break. But sometimes you just want to have a break in the way you're presenting the material. A first grader sitting in this type of classroom with me standing here talking to them and just feeding lots of information to them, they won't last very long. So you need to vary the activity. Maybe it's just sending them to the blackboard to practice writing their letters and then sending them back to their desk to write it on their desk. That can be a break. Provide times of movement. The more movement, the better, within reason. Many of our brains actually record information better if they're accompanied by movement. So use of movement can simply be from class table, from their desk to the class table and back again. It might also be a type of movement that you are incorporating into what you're doing, such as marching in place as you count, clapping while you count by tens, motions for when you're teaching letter sounds, or motions for key content of subject material. But use motion. Sometimes like an ADHD child might even need a ball to squeeze while they're learning their material. Use chants, rhymes, and songs as often as practical. Teach your students to pay attention. The key to this is to make sure that you have their attention before you begin. If you don't have their attention, then it's not their fault. They're not paying attention. Signals aid in getting their attention. Put their name into the instructions. Gently insist that they pay attention. Yes, students need to be taught to pay attention, but some children really struggle with paying attention. I had a little first grader last year that seemed like there was so much stuff coming at him that he blanked out. It is like everything whited out. And we worked really hard to get him to pay attention. And toward the end of the year, I was pleased with where he was with paying attention. But if I'd have said, if you don't pay attention, you're going to stay in recess and do this at recess, it wouldn't have worked. It would have backfired on me. And some students, I have learned, are paying attention, even though they don't look like it. Like, I look around this room of teachers, and some of you are writing, and some of you might be looking out the window, but I hope you're all tuned into what I'm saying. And that's how we do as adults. We don't always focus on the teacher. But then some children that aren't focused, their minds aren't focused either. So get to know your students. Know which ones know what they're doing and which ones don't. Give students time to think. Have a wait time after you ask questions. If you wait 5 to 7 seconds after you ask a question, you get better answers. You're usually going to have a fast thinker and a slow thinker. So who do you really need to reach? Probably the slow thinker. Give them time. Use your walls. Use your flashcards. I teach using CLE's Learning to Read. We put our wall cards up on the wall, and they stay up there all year. The first year I taught, I didn't do that. And it was one of the big mistakes I made that year. Use charts. The classroom I used to teach in had very little wall space, and I was putting stuff on the ceiling because I had too many charts and too many aids that need to go up. Use those for first graders. They need them. They don't hear it and remember it. Use flashcards for drill and review. Drill and review are just as important to a first grader as the actual teaching of the material. I never have figured out how much time you spend teaching the actual material versus how much time you spend reviewing and reviewing and reviewing and reviewing and reviewing. But that's probably more important than the teaching. Classroom management is important. First graders don't know what they're supposed to do. I once talked to a public school kindergarten teacher, and soon after school started, and I was talking about some of the way things were kind of hectic, and she says, "Oh, I know, it's just like herding cats." And I thought that was the perfect example of children that come to school, and they really want to do the right thing, but they don't know how to do all of this stuff. You know, just the simple thing of where to put the answers on the page is so confusing at the beginning of the year. So they need to be taught the routines, procedures, and expectations that you have for them, because you cannot effectively teach material until you've taught the routines. And it often takes 2 or 3 weeks for them to really get in the groove of learning. After about 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the class, I'll stop and think, Okay, we really are getting somewhere with just school. When you are teaching routines and procedures, teach each one as you get to it. Like when it's recess time, teach the first time, teach them then what you want them to do for recess or after recess. Tell the students how to do it, but a lot of times spoken words don't make a whole lot of sense to first graders. Show them how to do it. And then have the students practice doing it. And if they can't get it all right, no, tell them that's good. Let's practice it again. Actually, you probably need, even if they get it right, you might want to practice a couple of times. And then after they know what to do, throughout the year, well, it's actually pretty common. After every recess, I'll tell them, okay, what two things do you need to remember before you go in? They all line up before we go in. So they have to tell me, be quiet, walk in the halls. Because if I don't tell them and then they don't do it, I mean, if I don't remind them and they don't do it, then I have another issue on my hands and it becomes frustrating. So after I tell them and then they don't do it, then it's a discipline issue. But don't tell them, let them tell you. Because then there's some active learning taking place. And if students fail to follow a procedure, practice with them again. Even in the middle of the year, sometimes they'll get sloppy with their habits. And so, okay, class, you were not looking at me when I call for your attention. We need to practice this. Just sharpen. They know what to do, but they just get sloppy. And a teacher sometimes gets sloppy, too. I have on your handout a list of procedures and routines you might want to think about, especially if you've never taught before. There might be others that you need to do, or some of these might not even apply. But these are things you need to think about how you want your students, not just first graders, but first graders need to be taught this type of thing. What to do when they get to school. You know, my students come in, they're to unpack their backpack. They put their homework folder in a certain tray. Their library books go on a certain shelf to be returned to the library. Put their lunchbox in the cubby. They hang up their backpack, put their coat, because sometimes they come in and shed it on the floor if you're not careful. And even though they know, and I teach them to do that, sometimes I still have to say, Cameron, put your backpack away. Use the restroom, get a drink, all of that type of stuff they're supposed to do. They need to be told how to come to class and how to get ready for a class. We have a new school, so last year I was able to have lots of space, and we had class on the floor. I had 11 students. They sit at tables rather than desks, and so class table wasn't much advantage over there, and I didn't have room for a class table, but we had a nice circle on the floor in front of the blackboard. That's where I held class. Usually they came with no pencils or books, but if they came with pencils or books, they went behind them on the floor. They each had a placemat that they sat on, and I just picked them up at a discount place for cheap, and they knew where to sit. They knew the routines. Teach them how to leave class, how to hand in papers and books, how to get a sharp pencil, how and when to ask permission to speak, how to line up for leaving the classroom, what they need to do at recess. And we play with another classroom, so we don't always talk about what's going to happen at recess until we're all together as a group. So what do they need to do? Restroom procedures, you know, what you expect of them. And it's the first day of first grade and the students aren't familiar with your school. Make sure that they understand that the boys go in the boys' bathroom, the girls go in the girls' bathroom, and that they know where the restrooms are. Because sometimes it's restroom time and first day of school, and all of a sudden I get this blank look. It's only happened once or twice because we usually have kindergarten for 2 weeks in the spring before, and so then they know that. What to do at lunch, how to line up at the water fountain, how to answer questions from the teacher. And I have two signals that I give for answering questions from the teacher. Sometimes I need a raised hand answer because I want one person to answer the question. A lot of times I like them all to answer the question. So I try to teach them to watch for my signal. So I usually, you know, ask whatever we're doing, give them a little bit of wait time. Well, when I'm asking the question, I'm giving them the signal if I want them to raise their hand, because otherwise they start talking right away if I don't. But, you know, if I want them to raise their hand, I just put my hand up. If they're supposed to all tell me, you know, I might say have a wait, and then give that signal, and they all tell me the answer, especially if you're doing fact recall where it's, you know, one word answers, that type of thing. How to do partner work, what to do if they get done with their work. There are some different signals that you can use, and a lot of these are pretty common. There's one that I found that I really like, that the students like. It takes a little bit of time to make sure I have it with me. This is called a slide whistle, and it came with our music program. And see if I can do it without making it squawk. You can do all kinds of sounds like that. It's actually working with their head voice, but I do that, and then they mimic it back to me and all turn and look at me. That's another interesting way of getting their attention. Different motions you might give as signals, and student signals. You know, sometimes you might have things that they want. You want them to give you a signal, like when I went to school, if you wanted to go to the library, you held up your book. Things like that that you might want to think about. And just because I have all these things listed out here, do I have them always figured out? No. Sometimes I change the routine in the middle of the class because it's not working for that class or that situation. Or like I said, we moved into a new school last year, so I had to figure out new routines and new ways of doing things. And sometimes you can't really do it until you actually do it. So you find something that works better. Okay. I want to go into some of the different areas of things that you'll be teaching. And a lot of these things are on your handout somewhere. And I did not put everything on your handout, so you can use your handout to jot down some of the more particular ideas. What does a first grader think they will learn to do when they come to school? What do you think they're going to do? What do they think that going to school is all about?
Learning to read.
And you've probably all heard stories about the child that goes home after the first day of school and, I didn't learn to read. Not every child has that experience, but there are some that think they're going to learn how to read on that first day of school. So that's the big part of first grade, is learning to read. And you're going to spend a big part of your school day teaching them to read. A good learning to read program includes the following, and I am taking these out of this book right here, Why Our Children Can't Read and What We Can Do About It. This lady has done a lot of reading research. If you're familiar with the Core Knowledge Foundation, they are developing a reading program based on her reading approach. It's kind of, it's a thick book, and it's got a lot of technical terms in it, but it changed the way I taught reading to first graders. If you use CLE's Learning to Read, that uses somewhat this approach. I don't follow her approach totally, but uses somewhat that approach, and so what I'm saying here probably isn't going to be a lot different. But a good reading program includes phonemic awareness, which that is basically training in the ability to blend or put sounds together or segment or take sounds apart. The individual phonemes. A phoneme is the smallest part of sound, which your consonants and your vowels are phonemes. A good reading program teaches a sound to symbol association. It teaches students to connect the phonemes, they hear it, to individual letters or letter combinations, which basically it's a symbol. It doesn't really have meaning until we give it meaning. You know, you can draw a picture of a house on the board, and it's not the real house. It's just a symbol of the house. And a good reading program stresses the sounds of the alphabet before the letter names. A lot of my students come in knowing letter names because they had siblings that taught them or parents who taught them the ABCs. But I don't spend a lot of time stressing about teaching them the letter names. I do the sounds, and then sometimes I do have to go back and teach them letter names later. And a good reading program covers the skill areas of, I already said, phoneme analysis, segmenting, blending, reading, and then writing and spelling, all in conjunction with each other. So blending is an important skill that we start right away
In fact, if they learn how to blend before they have to sound words, it's much easier for them to sound words. And this comes from that book. There's also a lot of other reading research that will tell you that this is something that is important. I usually begin, because it's easiest, begin with compound words. And I don't always use a visual aid. If you have a learning challenge student, you might need a visual aid. They might even need to touch it and feel it and put it together. But I often do start with a visual aid. These are just big Duplo blocks. You could use any block. You can even use pens, markers, pull what's off your desk. And so we're going to blend, and we're going to do this as a group here, the word hot dog, which I already told you what it's going to be. But as a teacher, I would say hot dog, and then they need to say it back and put it together. So I would say hot dog, and they'll say hot dog, hot dog. So just try that. Hot dog, hot dog. After they can do compound words, which usually doesn't take very long, we do two-syllable words like tulip. So I'll tell you the sound, you all blend it back, say it back to me and blend it. Tulip. Then we move on to three sound words like computer. And when they're doing that, that's a fairly artificial stage. It might just take a day or so. Maybe some children will get it the first day. Then you move on to words with three sounds. And I found long vowel words are easiest to start with. So if I say, and you probably are going to put them on a table so you can point to them, but B-O-T, you say B-O-T. Okay, so you get the idea. And after they can do long vowel words, move on to short vowel words. And when they are very good at that, move on to words with consonant blends. And that's the tricky part. The consonant blends are much harder for them to stick together quickly. And when they get to those words, it's also easy for them to jump over a letter in a blend. And then when students meet words that they need to sound, we use the same process. But first I have them, instead of me saying the sounds, they would say each sound. So I might show them this, and then they would say, jam. And, you know, they've learned how to do that already, so all they're thinking about is this. They just need to remember the sound that goes with this symbol that they see. They don't have to think about putting all of it together. They've already learned part of the step. So let's just try that with this word. Break it apart first, and then we'll put it together. So, ham. I know that there's a lot of programs that teach word starters, and I used a program longer ago that did that. I like starting right away with three-letter words because it fits in with how I like to teach better, but it also, they have to look at the whole word that way. It eliminates so much word guessing, like, you know, it could be ham or hat or whatever. They have to focus on the whole word. But if you're having success with your word starters, I'm not going to take away from that. There's people that think that's definitely the way to go. They eventually outgrow that artificial process of needing to break everything apart. Some children need to be coached that, see if you can't just look at it and say it. You know, I'll see them doing it in their heads before they say it. And after a point, you want it to become a sight word that they can just blip off without needing to break it apart. But if they mess up on a word, we go right back, break it apart. You know, say the letters for me, especially when you get to longer words. Then segmenting is the opposite of blending. And I usually teach this when we're doing spelling words. It's easier for them to break it into individual sounds once they know what those sounds are supposed to be. So if you have the word sad, which is one of the first words that we learn to spell, it has three sounds. And so I would say sad, and we might stretch it out, sad, and then we break it apart. So do that. You say sad, we'll stretch sad out, and then you break it apart with me, and we'll put that little pause between each sound. So sad, sad, sad. So how many sounds did you see? Did you hear? You saw? Three. So now you need to make sure you have three letters on your page, and you know the first one was sad. It's teaching them to really think about and analyze these words. And I like to have them counted off, because when you get to consonant blend words or words with more sounds, after you get about five sounds in a word, it's kind of artificial to try to figure it all out. But that makes them think about what they're really hearing. And I will often, as they're writing in the beginning, as they're writing things down, I'll go ahead and I'll repeat it again, s-a-d, just so they can be hearing it. After a while, you want to drop that, because you want them to start thinking that through themselves. First graders need to be taught, and I got a little ahead of myself here, first graders need to be taught the sound that goes with the shape. They need to know that it can come at the beginning of a word, the middle of a word, and the ending of a word. And I found that a lot of reading programs maybe err on teaching the beginning of the word and then kind of forget that these sounds need to be listened for at other places. So you want to be aware of that. Some sounds you don't hear at the end of a word. And of course, vowel sounds you're going to hear in the middle of a word. But just be careful with always asking them, what's the first sound you hear in such and such a word? Now, I might also say, okay, today we're going to listen for the d sound. Well, it's probably not d because that's the first one. I'll probably wait till about the fourth or fifth letter. And do you hear it first, last, or both? So they need to listen for that. Little of this learning is actually tangible, which you can touch and feel. So you need to find ways to help the student make connection with the material and to remember the material. So using rhymes and motions for each letter. I like CLE's approach. They have a rhyme, and there's a motion that goes with each letter. So this one goes, d, 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 Debbie Duck can say quack, but can't say cluck. So later on, they're thinking, d, d, what's d? And you can just do like, oh, they know. You don't even have to say the, or sometimes I go through and have to say the first letter. That's a good way to help them. A school teacher friend of mine does a special activity with each letter, and I don't know what they all are, and I didn't have the opportunity to ask her, but the one I remember seeing a picture of was when her students read the story about Ping, where the principal read the story about Ping to her students. So the principal and the story about Ping, and they were learning the sound. I thought that was pretty neat. Mnemonics is another way to help students remember. When you sing the alphabet song, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, actually the alphabet itself is a mnemonic aid. Some mnemonics are just silly stories that help students remember things. When I'm teaching the D versus the B, I use this little story. Now, this is going to be backwards to how a lot of people make this letter, so this might not be beneficial to all of you. But we have, first of all, I need to tell you about this little person. This is Mr. Smiley Guy. He always goes at the beginning of the year in the left-hand corner, top corner of the paper. So when we're writing our letters, he helps us with orientation. So we have this diver here, and I'm not a good illustrator, but works for first graders. And dives down to the floor, and then he comes back up and he says, hello, did I do a good dive? Which, that would not be a good duh. That's made a little differently than a lot of people make theirs. So when we have we have a bumblebee, And you can even stick the stinger back there if you want to. And we have, nobody likes bumblebees, at least my class always, most of them run away from bumblebees. So we have, B is the bee, and he buzzes down to the floor, and then you chase him away because you don't want him close to you. So do we have a diver, or do we have a bee? That helps most children that have problems with that DB orientation. Not all children can't even remember that, but, and I sympathize with them because I have a bad left-right problem. So I'm thinking, okay, I can remember which is which. It's no wonder they can't remember which one is which. I start an SSR period right away at the beginning of the year. That's a silent, sustained reading period where you might take 15 minutes and they read the book of their own choice. First graders can't read. But I go ahead and start right at the beginning of the year, and they look at books. I usually do it in connection with our library period when we go to the library and then they get to choose a book to take home, and then they spend the rest of the time looking at books. Now, if you had a multi-grade setting, you could have second graders read to first graders in that period. But I go ahead and just get them interacting with books as often as possible. And then as they're learning to read, I might suggest, here's a book. Why don't you see if you can try to read this? If you have the little Dick, Jane, and Sally readers in your library, those are good for students to start, start coaching them into that reading. So where should you be by midterm? Well, ideally, students should be able to read and spell three-letter words using all the consonants and all the short vowels. They should be able to read those words independently and orally at about 20 words a minute, probably with some, like they might have practiced the list and then read it about 20 words a minute. They should be able to independently read a short story and retell what they read. They should be able to do the major part of their lesson pretty much correctly with minimal help from the teacher beyond the teaching of the new material. Now, that's ideal. What if they're not there? And depending on your circumstances and situations, you might not be there. I have first graders coming in who most of them have a pretty good foundation laid. They're not taught a huge kindergarten foundational knowledge, but they're not coming in and I'm not having to teach them how to write their names. I'm not having to teach a lot of these just very basic things. They have some foundation there. So if you're coming in and you're teaching them that color is blue and yellow and trees are green, you're not going to be there. It's going to depend on where they are to begin with. But wherever you think you should be, if they're not starting to become independent workers and starting to become independent workers, then maybe you're moving too fast. If they're not becoming, if you're far enough ahead in your books, but students are frustrated and you're frustrated because you're having to help them, slow down, back up, get some of that basic stuff down. And I am talking to myself as much as anyone because I usually have some students who are just able to keep moving, and then there's that one or two children that can't quite keep up, and I want to get through this material and I want to get to this part and this part, and I'm okay, back up, slow down. And of course you have these faster learners who are getting a little frustrated because they don't like doing all this drill. They want to really learn to read. They want to read books from the library. You got to balance it all. Give lots of practice until they learn well enough to master master the concepts. It's better to lay a good foundation than to just cover the books. First graders need to be successful. And I would say that probably for most students, whether they have a good school year or not, a good school years or not, depends on how their first grade year is. If they don't have a good first grade year, Somebody may come along and pick up the pieces later. There's all kinds of stories of people that had success later in life because of somebody that came along and picked up the pieces. But I would say that that's probably going to be rare rather than the norm. If a child has a good first grade experience, they have a better chance of having a good experience the rest of their school years. You don't control all the strings there, but you do control some of them. Success begets success. It's important to not move too quickly at the beginning of the year. It's so basic for us as adults. This material is so basic, and we think it should be so easy for them to learn to do that we can soon start flying along, and all of a sudden then we come up against a brick wall. They've had overload and it crashes and they can't remember anything. Don't go too quickly. If you're getting frustrated, back up and stop. And if the student's getting frustrated, you probably will get frustrated too. Penmanship, writing, goes right along with learning to read. A student should be writing the same sound that he is learning to read. And I would say probably most of our reading curriculums would teach it right in connection with each other. It doesn't really make sense to teach them that D says D, but you learn to write the letter A. When we are learning to write a new letter, the teacher should first model the process on the board. And then after I show them how to do it, I often show them all the wrong ways that I can figure out that they're going to write it. So if we are learning D, well, there's going to be some child who writes it backwards, who pops it in the air, and they love to. I say, well, does this look like a good one? And no. And so then, what's wrong with it? Well, he bumped his toes, or he hopped up too high, or his head sticking through the ceiling. And then we get to the one, and then I finally finish up with a good one. And if I don't do that, after a while, they say, well, you forgot to make the bad ones. I often will have use a rhythmic chant. So when we make a D, I would say, D, down, down, hello, around. And so when we're doing that the whole time, it's down, hello, around. Down, hello, around, and try to do it at a rate that they can, you want to say the words as they're making the motion. And most of them, you can look at the letter and figure out very quickly what rhythm you want to use. I don't have a set rhythm with some of the letters, and so sometimes I'm saying different things and they look at me kind of funny, like, that's not how you did that last time. So after I model it on the board, then we practice writing with large ones in the air, and you don't want to just have them take their fingers and do this. You want to get a large body motion, and I was going to, and I forgot to bring my laser, but I picked up a clue a couple years ago. If you as a teacher have a laser, you can stand at the back of the classroom, you can make a big letter on the wall, and they're supposed to be tracing that. So we do that for a little bit, and we say that. Say the chant as we do it, and then we practice on the board, or I had limited space for a long time, and even now, I can't get all of my students at the chalkboard at one time. So what I have done is I take a page protector and stick a penmanship paper in this page protector, and I usually put Mr. Smiley Guy's sticker up in the corner, and then they each have a dry erase marker, usually the fine tip, and we use that to practice the writing, and I can walk around their desks and see if they're making them correctly or not. And then they can erase it off and you can store it. Once I see that everyone knows how to write the letter, then we usually open up our workbooks and write it in our workbooks. And we often do the lesson when we're learning these letters, we do it together in unison. So when we're making D, pencil on the dot, down, hello, around, pencil on the dot, down, hello, around, D. you have a child who's, it's not going to, their pencil doesn't go the right way for them the first time, usually I tell them, don't go back and erase it now. We'll go back and fix it up later. For one thing, most children aren't, they don't have that, it's not just, you know, when we write, we don't think about what we're doing. We just make that fluid motion. They are concentrating on how every part of it needs to go. So I'm not stressing out on neatness at this point. Because, yes, you don't want them sitting all over the lines. You know, you want a basic form, but it doesn't have to be perfect. We work on that later on in the year. So I try to not let them use their erasers while we're doing it, and then we go back and fix it up. So some tips for making letters. I wanted to mention, back when I was talking about the mnemonics in the reading, I have a lot of them written down. They're not in your handout because it would have made it several more pages long. A lot of them are in the CLE, Learning to Read Teacher's Guide. But if you would like a copy of what I do, there, put my email address on the back page. That feel free to email me, and I'll send you the list instead of trying to go over all of them. Okay, we already talked about Mr. Smiley Guy. There's different things you can do with your lines. I use the house analogy, and there's different ways you can do that. But this is our roof. This is our ceiling, this is our floor, and then down here we have the basement. So we talk about the roof and the ceiling, and you know, they like to get the idea that something will go through the ceiling and go up to the roof up above, or we stomp real hard, and it wouldn't work here because there's no basement. We don't have a basement under my room either, but you know, stomp real hard and you go down to the basement. That helps with their orientation. When you start writing words, you're going to have to teach students how to space their letters. They often will write like ancient writing. Everything has the same space between it. And even when you teach them how to space, put bigger spaces between words, sometimes they are putting so much space between each individual letter, it still doesn't look like there's a space between the word. But to work on that, you could use a finger or a popsicle stick or a crayon or something like that as a spacer. One of my favorite things to do with any child, it's my favorite and my least favorite because it's a fair amount of work, is what we call journal time. It's not true journal time. It's our composition class, but composition is that's too big of a term. So they like to journal. And do we start at the beginning? Maybe not the first week, but yes. We should start right away. They can't write anything down yet. But they love to tell stories. 6-year-olds love to tell stories. And they can draw pictures. So they draw pictures. And I wish I had time. I'll have to maybe leave this here and you all can look at it. But they draw pictures. And then I often will write their story down if I have time. But this one says, when I grow up, I'm going to have a cabin. I'm going to have a river close by so I can go fishing, and a patch of woods nearby so I can go hunting with a bow and arrow. And this is the big windstorm. The tree fell down. I'm going, oh, because the tree fell down. So it's a form of expression for them, and they love to journal. And I've had older students that still enjoy writing just because it was fun in first grade. So we usually do this about twice a week. I use this period for a couple of different purposes. One is I want to introduce the children to good writing and good stories. So this might be another reason they like journaling class. It's because we always start with a story. And I take the opportunity to use a classic story or a folk tale, or I even use fairy tales. You would have to know if that's okay with your parents and your school policy. We talk about how stories have passed down, like especially with the fairy tales. Talk about how years ago, and I have the timeline on my wall, so you know I can show them the Middle Ages, how people didn't write their stories down. There were storytellers, and they passed the story down. You know, Grandma told little Johnny, and Johnny grew up, and he told Johnny Jr., and so on. And then the Grimm brothers came along, and they collected these stories, and they wrote them down. Now we have them today. A lot of fairy tale stories reflect on how people thought about life in those, in that time period. If you, you know, a lot of the stories, and I'm a little careful when I read this, if I read Hansel and Gretel, I don't read about the witch. She's an old woman. But in those days, it was very real that they thought an old, widowed lady, woman, was a witch. I mean, she could very well be accused of being a witch. So that's why all the witches in those books are old ladies, and we don't go into all of that type of stuff, but they often do teach a concept of how they thought about life then. I also like to use books with good illustrations and fine art when I can find them. So that part of the class is as much about writing and art appreciation as it is actual student writing. The next purpose is to help students put their thoughts in order and verbalize what those thoughts are. And I've already said that the students draw and tell their story. And I usually let them do whatever they want to do. I've had some years where it really distressed them to be given a topic that they had to write about. I learned that I needed to tell them, okay, next time we have journal class, we're going to be writing about the field trip that we took. Because they had their ideas. They wanted to use their ideas. Some children, though, it's good if you know a little bit about what's going on in their life, because they can't think what to write. So keep your ears open at recess and remind them what they did the day before or something that you know is exciting to them. You might have to prime the pump for some of them. And then I like to have students become comfortable speaking to a group. And it gives them a purpose for their story. Have a share time. They love to get up and tell their stories. And it helps them learn how to speak to a group. This little boy, I don't know that he was so shy, but it was really hard to understand him. He would kind of slur his words together and be very quiet. And so I'd have to tell him, Nathan, speak up. We didn't catch what you said. We want to know what your interesting story is about. Till the end of the year, that was not a problem. He could speak at recess, so I knew he could. And then I already alluded to the idea of the teacher can write the story down. I don't always do that. Depends if I have time. One year I had students who stretched their stories out for a long time, and I got tired of writing, so I typed them in on my computer and printed them out and glued them on. That was much faster. The teacher is an encourager at this time. You take a back seat. You let the student go where they want to go. This is a good way to push the good student a little bit and pull the poor student along, and you can treat them all pretty much the same. They all can be successful with this. Put their stories on a bulletin board, or each one of my students has a ring binder that I put a cover in, and they have their collection for the year then, and they go back and they like to read them, and oh yeah, they remember when they did that. Numbers and more. I enjoy teaching reading. Math is a little harder, so my math things aren't quite as helpful maybe. Students need to have a good sense of numbers before you move on into harder concepts. If they're just counting because they've memorized the numbers 1 to 10 or even 1 to 100, those numbers don't mean anything to them. Well, addition and subtraction is not going to mean anything either. Some pre-math skills that you might want to watch for: can they count objects matching the object to the number, or do they have the idea of counting as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Oh, they have 10 blocks. You know, you need to be able to have one-to-one mapping there. They might be able to count to 100, but they probably don't know what those big numbers really represent. Some other concepts: before, after, larger, smaller, longest, shortest, top, bottom, more, less, greatest, least. Those can all be confusing. And I ran into a new one last year. I had a number line like this on the board, on the wall. It was the first time I did a number line that was a continued number line. And they had such problems, some of them, with before and after numbers. Because usually we kind of tend to think that this number on the right is first. When you have a line of things, this side is going to be first. And this side is last. That's not how numbers work. So we have 70 up here, and they couldn't remember if 71 was the before number or the after number. So, yeah, I'm not sure that at the end of the year that the one little girl still always had it figured out. A few tips for teaching different math skills. When you're learning to write the numbers, use the number rhymes, and I have them in the front, in your handout somewhere. A straight line down, and then you're done. That's how to make a one around and back on a 2-2 track. Around and back on a railroad track. Choo, choo, choo. Something like that. I'd say them without thinking, but then can't remember it. Use things they can handle. Blocks, straws, toothpicks, Cheerios. I have a box of zoo animals, and they love to count those and do story problems with those. Use things they can touch. When you're doing clocks, use a real clock. I have several real clocks that don't work anymore, and they are good for teaching math. Use real money. Measure real things. So use things you can touch. Teach the higher numbers by families. So you have the teen family, the 20 family. And I think on your handout it says triplets. That was a mistake, so it should say families. The 30s and so on. Few families that are difficult for children is the teen families, the 20s, the 30s, and the 50s, because they don't, 40 and 60 and 70 and 80 and 90, they have that sound of the number that's in front. We do this drill that said teen means who's in front. Teen means who's in front.
One.
20 means who's in front.
Two.
And so on, all the way up. And I mix them up so they're not just going 1, 2, 3. 13 and 15 is another tricky one. So if a student is having problems with the teens, and I'm talking 11, 12, 13, and 15, we change their names. They're 1-teen, 2-teen, 3-teen, 5-teen, until they can learn what they are. Use language the students understand. Somehow, birthdays and candy make more sense to them than apples and bananas. There was a little boy this past year that had struggled with math. His family had a produce stand, and he knew all about the produce on the stand, and he was very helpful with that. So we started talking about, well, if there's two tomatoes on the shelf and a customer comes and, buys one tomato, how many is left? Well, he knew right away, but give him something a little abstract. Even if you had two pieces of candy and you ate one, it didn't quite make sense. Or if you had, if you put 2 ears of corn in a bag and your little brother put 2 ears of corn in the bag, well, how many ears of corn are in the bag? Well, then he knew. Use language they are comfortable with, that they know what to do. Make use of your flashcards and your practice sheets. There's different drills that you can do. I'm not going to go over all of them. Probably your math curriculum will have some ideas for that. Use extra practice sheets. Rod and staff has some good black lines. There's a new math being published by Foundational Math, and I have their black lines. I also have made my own black lines for that follow the CLE sequence. But they usually have a fact paper like you see her doing there every day. Now, of course, that's probably the middle of the term. Start oral problems right away. They're thinking problems. Act them out. Draw pictures on the board. Have them draw pictures in their books. Use real objects. Get them thinking about what they're doing. I don't teach third and fourth grade, so maybe I'm saying this a little falsely, but I don't like students to be dependent on those clue words, more or less. I like them to actually be able to understand what they're doing. So you want to start that at the very beginning, and you can actually start helping them think through things using higher numbers than they have actually learned facts for if you use objects, that type of thing. So where should you be in math by midterm? Well, hopefully wherever you're at, students are comfortable with it. They're fairly accurate and they're fairly independent with practice work. If they're not, slow down, drill, bring them up to speed. So we've covered a lot of area in this key content, and I don't think we're going to have time for question and answers. I hope you're going to come back tomorrow, and maybe then we will. I'm going to be talking tomorrow about some other subjects that we cover in first grade. I have a few words I want to leave with you. Believe in your students. That is a big key. You believe in them, they'll probably believe in you. Establish an atmosphere of trust and learning. Make your classroom safe for your students. And here is one that is probably the key point of all of teaching. Ask God for the wisdom to know what to do and the strength to carry it out. There was one year I was dealing with a student who, it was not just a student problem, it was a parent problem. And every day, I knew that I was going to have issues every day, or that I was going to face situations every day that it was easier to let slide. And that became a very key part, asking God for wisdom, and then the courage to carry it out. You know what to do sometimes, but you also need to be brave enough to make that word stick. So God bless you all, and hope you have a wonderful start to your first grade, and I hope some of you will be back tomorrow.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.